It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll talk about the history of America as told through 101 objects in the Smithsonian's collection.
First, the Food and Drug Administration announced today that it wants to start requiring producers to gradually phase out artificial trans fats in their food. These fats have been linked to numerous health problems. Many food producers have already taken steps to phase them out.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about that decision? Have you made efforts already to try to remove trans fats from your own diet? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Michael Jacobson. He's executive director of the Center for Science and the Public Interest. Michael, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Glad to be on your show.
So first of all, what is the thing we're taking out of food here? What are trans fats?
Trans fats are formed when liquid vegetable oil is treated with hydrogen and it becomes more solid. There used to be a lot of trans fat in Crisco, in margarines, and some other foods. And the problem with it is the most harmful fat in the food supply. It promotes heart disease. It raises the bad cholesterol, lowers the good cholesterol, and it also stiffens arteries. So it's bad stuff.
And when I see on a label partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, that's usually the trans fat bearing part of the ingredient list?
That's right. That's the ingredient that introduces this artificial trans fat into packaged foods. There's a little bit of trans fat in the food supply from meat fat and milk fat. But you can have skim milk and very low-fat beef, and you wouldn't get much, if any. But the bulk of it has come from the added partially hydrogenated fats in packaged foods and in restaurant foods.
So why do restaurateurs, why do food processors add the stuff to food? What do they get out of it?
Well, it's been cheap, and some foods need a hard fat, like partially hydrogenated oil. Some of those partially hydrogenated so-called oils have the consistency of ivory soap. And as every baker knows, you need a solid fat, like butter, or a solid margarine that has trans fat, to get a flaky crust, flaky pastries. You can't use liquid vegetable oil. And so oil processors and bakers have figured out what are good substitutes. And so New York City, they banned trans fat from restaurants and bakeries. Consumers didn't notice the difference. McDonald's said it didn't get a single complaint. Bakeries initially hollered that their survival is in doubt. But they all changed and are serving baked goods that are healthier for the consumer.
So a lot of people might be listening and say, okay, maybe it's not so great for us. Does it really merit effectively banning it by the FDA?
Well, at its peak of use in the mid-2000s, 2005, 2004, Harvard University scientists estimated that trans fat was causing 50,000 premature deaths every year. 50,000, it's a lot of deaths. And now I would estimate 75% of the trans fat is gone because of state laws, lawsuits that we and others have filed, huge adverse publicity, and the FDA requiring trans fat information on the nutrition facts labels of packaged foods. So 75% is gone, so that 50,000 estimate of deaths per year is way down. And if the FDA follows through and finalizes its preliminary decision, that would get rid of these unnecessary deaths totally.
Talking about the FDA announcement that they're looking to get trans fats out of food in America, they've just kicked off a 60-day public comment period. We have Michael Jacobson with us from the Center for Science and the Public Interest. What do you think? Do you think it's high time that trans fats were banned, or do you think they should be there and consumers make the decision at the point of sale? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org. Michael, as I've looked around at response to this, that's one of the most common objections. Again, we know it's bad, but I'm a consumer. I should be able to decide if I want to buy something with that ingredient or if I don't. I can buy cigarettes if I want them or not. Is it a personal choice issue?
Well, the FDA needs to enforce the law. The law says, thou shalt not add dangerous ingredients to foods. And this is clearly a dangerous one. And I can't imagine that consumers will object, because there hasn't been a single complaint, as far as I know of, when 75% of the trans fat has been removed from restaurants and packaged foods. You know, the food looks the same, tastes the same, costs the same. You know, there's just no point in objecting. And, you know, I suppose if somebody, for some perverse reason, wanted to eat partially hydrogenated oil, they could buy it from some chemical supply house. But, you know, if it tasted different, you know, if you couldn't make French fries without partially hydrogenated oil, then I could see people objecting that they want their French fries. But companies have found substitutes for every use. And we've looked at different categories of food where some brands have trans fat. And in every one of those categories, cookies, cakes, pie crusts, and so on, we found other brands that don't have trans fat. So companies clearly could make it. You know, we found microwave popcorns have, some brands like Pop Secret and Jolly Time, have large amounts, 5 grams, 4 grams, which is twice as much trans fat as the Heart Association recommends for an entire day in one modest serving of popcorn. Those brands have a lot of trans fat, but Orville Redenbacher's and Act Two and so on, they don't have any trans fat. And what I've heard is the reason that some companies don't want to change is they would have to buy a slightly more expensive packaging that that can hold more liquid oils. You know, so that's just a commercial reason, and there's no difference in price. Consumers, you know, they're going to end, if they buy the ones with trans fat, they may end up paying the price at the hospital.
So there is apparently some room for trans fats to stick around, it sounds like, but a tall bar. Companies who don't support taking the fats out of their food, the burden would be on them to prove scientifically that partially hydrogenated oils are safe to eat. Do you think that anybody could rise to that bar and keep trans fats in their food if they wanted to?
I don't think so. And, you know, I work on this a lot, and I haven't heard companies for years saying trans fat is not harmful. Instead, they say it's expensive to reformulate, or we've tried and we can't find a substitute oil. You know, it's those kinds of arguments. But, you know, I think, universal agreement that it's dangerous. I could see some companies saying, we haven't been able to change to find a substitute for our cherry turnovers, and maybe FDA would grant an exemption for them. Or, you know, maybe there's some, I heard of one company that uses just a tiny amount of partially hydrogenated oil for a flavor powder that it puts on snack chips. You know, so maybe that company would say, you know, this is just trivial, don't worry about it. But I think hopefully next year the FDA will issue a final rule that gets virtually all the trans fat out of virtually all the foods in which it's now used.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Alex with us in Stoughton. Alex, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. My question is there any potential risk that the guest sees there being dangers to these alternatives that are being used instead of trans fat? Can we foresee something being realized in the future that says, oh, these weren't bad for us, these weren't good for us either?
Gotcha. Alex, thanks for the call. His line cut out there at a critical moment. He's saying that, are there risks of the things we would substitute for the trans fats?
I haven't heard of any. Trans fat is is and partially hydrogenated oil. Those are the worst fats in the food supply. So for a baked good, a company will have to switch to another hard fat. But when we've looked, the amounts of the saturated fat that replaces the trans fat is usually less. So and also, even if it's the same or more, trans fat is much more harmful than saturated fat, so there's a benefit.
So we know that...
Okay. The one downside is that some companies are switching to palm oil, and a great deal of palm oil is produced and imported from Indonesia and Malaysia. And to harvest much of the... or to plant palm oil, palm trees, oil palm trees, companies destroy rainforest. And when the rainforest goes, so do the rhinoceroses and orangutans and other animals in the rainforest. So there's that that issue. But the palm oil industry is trying to develop better practices so they don't destroy more rainforest. And there are no orangutans in South America where some palm oil, or in Africa, where some palm oil is sourced.
All right, thanks for the call, Alex. We'll go to James in Kenosha now. James, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? This is James. I called because I was listening and I needed to comment. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I think it's absurd, the idea that someone could choose what's harmful and what's not harmful for people. That's a decision that they're allowed to make as human beings. I mean, they tried to ban smoking, but everyone knows smoking is bad for you, yet people do it. It's because they decided that they're willing to undergo the risk. You drink enough water, it's going to be bad for you. At what point are you going to draw the line? Are you going to draw the line with sugar? And then the added cost to society of hiring all these regulators that could be going out and actually producing some substitutes if they had industry and capitalism to spur them along. Instead, they're going around regulating markets and not letting the market work itself out and telling people what they're not allowed and allowed to put in their bodies. It's absurd.
Gotcha, James. I want to get a response from our guest, Michael. We don't need the regulations. Personal choice.
Well, there may be some people who really want a more harmful French fry or potato chip, but I would venture to say that 99.9% of the public isn't even aware of this issue and would be gratified that the government is stepping in where companies have not been responsible enough, and then the government would ban this unhealthy product. You know, it's crazy to leave something that's unhealthy in when the companies can make the exact same product with a healthier oil.
All right, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Michael Jacobson. He's executive director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
Coming up, we'll find out about the 101 objects that define American history, according to a new book from the Smithsonian. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
As the Smithsonian's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture, our next guest has firsthand knowledge of the 137 million items in the museum's collection.
His job this time around to join with scholars and curators to pick only 101 items from among millions that would collectively represent the American experience. Richard Curran joins us now. He's the author of The Smithsonian's History of 101 Objects. And Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, nice to be here, Veronica, Rob.
Well, the Smithsonian Collection, as we just said, it includes millions of objects, 137 million plus. How did you ever decide what to include to tell that story of America?
Well, not easily, I'll tell you that. The we have hundreds of curators, scientists, and scholars at the Smithsonian, and all had their suggestions about what should be included. And as you can imagine, you know, the folks at our postal museum, they were kind of partial to stamps, and the people at the Air and Space Museum partial to aircraft. But we got a good reading from our fellow curators. And then, you know, I kind of let the American people, our visitors, also help us decide. We get 30 million people come to the Smithsonian. They gravitate towards certain exhibitions. They want to see George Washington's uniform and the Star-Spangled Banner and Lincoln's hat and even Kermit the Frog and C-3PO. So, you know, we looked at what was popular among the American public, and then I filled in with some objects behind the scenes that people don't usually see or know about, but tells important chapters of America's history.
It was interesting to me. One of the things you said about the Smithsonian's collection is that it's visceral. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's like when you look at these things, you realize that, you know, it helps transport you to that time in history. Look, you know, this Saturday in Wisconsin, a whole lot of people are going to be singing, "Oh, Say Can You See," to, you know, to football games, high school and college games and pro games across the state. Well, very few Americans realize that that's about a flag that Francis Scott Key actually saw that September 14th, 1814, and he didn't know whether he'd see the British Union Jack or the American Stars and Stripes. And so when we sing that Star Spangled Banner, it's about that particular flag. And when you're in the Smithsonian and you look at that flag that's now 200 years old, threadbare, and you look at that flag and it looks so fragile, and yet it makes you think about the fragility of our country that time 200 years ago, where we could have lost our independence.
So with these 101 objects, I mean, is there something special to them being objects? I mean, we could read about that. We could read that anecdote in a book. It could be stirringly told. But is there something special about seeing it?
Well, yeah, because, you know, you're in the presence of it. It's kind of, it's almost like you're even though in the museum we don't allow people to touch, it's almost like you're there in the presence. It's just like celebrity. You know, you get, you could see a picture of somebody who's famous, but being in their presence is quite different. And being up close and intimate is another thing. And so I think the whole idea is that you can kind of commune with these objects. It's, you know, I've seen over and over again with many people who come to the Smithsonian or other museums in their home communities, you know, there almost is like a communion with the object in feeling that somehow I am connected to the events that this object portrays.
Do you still feel, as a curator, as undersecretary, do you still feel awe when you see some of these things?
Look, no question about it. You know, the Smithsonian collected after the tragedy of 9/11. We collected items from the world. We have pieces of the World Trade Center, fire truck doors from first responders, material from Shanksville, the logbook of the flight attendants that went down in that flight. We have, you know, material from the Pentagon. We did an exhibit about that material. We put it on tables, not fancy glass cases, not fancy installations, and people walked through, and tens of thousands of Americans came through that exhibit. You know, it was so quiet in the museum. And a sense of feeling history. And right in front of me was a teenager who'd been very young in, you know, 9/11. And he said, you know, I knew this was bad, but I was just a little kid then. I did not realize, I was not able to feel that history. Now, right next to this object, I can. That speaks very strongly to that experience.
Well, as long as you brought up September 11th, you know, let's start there instead of at the beginning of American history, because that must have been an incredibly emotionally wrenching experience. But at the same time, you folks at the Smithsonian, you're still trying to do your job. You're trying to collect the artifacts that will comprise history. How did you go about doing it then?
Yeah, not easily. And, you know, we, like, you know, every other American, were, you know, certainly burdened and incredibly, saddened and struck by that experience. And particularly at the Smithsonian, because with the Pentagon, you know, that was very close by. And we have museums in New York that are right near the Trade Center. But, you know, curators then thought about, okay, how are we going to capture this experience so generations from now Americans will know what this meant? And, you know, the ironic thing is, while people think of museums as displaying history, when they originally collect the material, it's almost like they're collecting the news. It's not history. You know, when we collected Edison's light bulb or Alexander Graham's telephone, you know, the first prototypes of that, they weren't history yet. They were new innovations that were changing America. That's why we collected them. And so with 9/11, there were decisions made about, you know, getting at the personal experience that people went through. We collected, there was one very plain item, a kind of squeegee used by a window washer at the World Trade Center. He used it to get out of the building, to pry open an elevator shaft and get out. It told a very personal story, having, you know, the fire engine door at the Smithsonian, that told the story of the first responders. So, you know, you try to choose carefully those objects. You know, the idea of curation is what you're trying to do is you're trying to tell a big and a complex story by collecting a piece of it. Same thing with the Civil War. We can't recreate, nor do we want to recreate the battles of the Civil War, but when you collect, you know, some of the artifacts of it, the bullets, the medical equipment, the uniforms and other things, you start the letters that people wrote, you get a piece of it, and by getting the pieces, you try to tell the whole.
Right now, we're talking to Richard Curran. He's the Smithsonian Institution's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture. He's the author of the new book, The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects.
And we want to hear from you. What object would you nominate to tell a key part of American history? We welcome your questions, your suggestions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Richard Curran. He's the Smithsonian Institution's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture, author of The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects.
And we want to hear from you on this one. What object do you nominate to tell a key part of the American story? Or do you have a question about something that you think is in this collection? We welcome your questions and your comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Richard, I want to start us off again with an object which surprised me, Sitting Bull's drawing book. This was fascinating. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, not many people know about it, but, you know, Sitting Bull, basically, when he was, finally turned himself in, started drawing scenes from his life, some of those conflicts were with other Native American groups, others were other episodes of his life, and you know, people would draw. He wasn't the only Native American leader to do that, but they did it in these relatively cheap, readily accessible books, you know, and like little notebooks. And they're fascinating drawings because they really depict iconography from his perspective. What gave him power? And so how did he think about his, different horses that he had ridden and went into battle with? So it's a marvelous glimpse into Sitting Bull's representation of his life.
And what do you make of the fact that he didn't include any drawings of his battles with the U.S. Army?
Well, in this particular book that we have at the Smithsonian, remember, there's a number of different of different books that were done, both by Sitting Bull and other leaders. So I did include, he hadn't done one about Little Bighorn, but Red Horse had done one, and I include that in the book. That is in our collection. And you see basically an American Indian vision of what Custer's troops look like as they would be defeated at Little Bighorn. It really changes your perspective.
And how did he draw them?
Well, what you see is, you know, in his drawing of that, you see the American flag kind of upside down. You see various cavalry soldiers, horsemen being upended from their horses. What they draw, though, is the people look very similar. Everybody looks kind of like the same. And you can imagine the uniformed, army looking the same. But the horses are all distinct. That is, you know, both Sitting Bull and Red Horse and others really had an eye for the distinctive characteristic and features of horses, more so than they did for people.
Interesting. All right, let's take a phone call now. John joining us from Richland Center. Hi, John.
Hi, good afternoon. I believe that the best American invention was the steel hammer, because carpenters build America. Everybody lives in a house, and the steel hammer is unbreakable.
All right. A vote there for a particular tool that's changed America. What do you think about that one, Richard?
Well, I do deal with steel because steel did make America in terms of certainly industrialization. And rather than the steel hammer, I dealt with basically Carnegie steel, which was, you know, used from everything from railroad tracks to industrial uses to even the use in Carnegie's home. And so I dealt with the development of, you know, steel during the Industrial Revolution, which really, you know, made modern America.
Now, going back to early history, you have George Washington's uniform and sword. And judging by the picture, they look beautiful. They don't look like what I would have imagined, I guess.
Well, and George Washington was very keen on this. He actually wrote and ordered the material. You know, he had served with the British as a member of the Virginia militia. He was an officer in the British Army. And he was very attuned to the fact that, you know, the British uniforms were pretty sharp and made the British look like an imperial power, which they were. Well, in becoming a commander of the U.S. forces, Washington was very keen on showing the British that we were not a ragtag bunch of rabble-rousers, but really knew what we were doing and had the dignity of soldiers. And so he really handcrafted his – he didn't sew the uniform himself, but he really ordered in a certain way with these particular colors based on the Virginia colors. And, you know, he wanted to look every bit the commander, and that was to give the British this impression that the U.S. Was a force to be contended with.
I can imagine that uniform would have done just that. It looks pristine and so stately when you see it.
Yeah, well, we've kept it pretty clean at the Smithsonian. So it probably looks better than it did at Valley Forge.
I hope so. Well, you know, we're talking about the objects that define American history, and not every chapter of American history is something to celebrate. You've got some difficult objects there, or at least objects that bring to mind difficult periods of history, including a Ku Klux Klansman uniform and an art also from Japanese internment era people who were there and obviously part of that. Could you talk about some of those more difficult pieces?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, I think it's our obligation as the National Museum, ours as, you know, scholars and curators to present, you know, the full story, you know, and some of those are difficult chapters. The particular painting of Japanese-American, it was done by a Japanese-American artist who'd been interned during World War II, and the particular painting shows a woman with an infant, and she's staring down at a picture of her son who was in the Army's 442 division. This was the same division that Senator Inouye was in. This is, you know, a man who lost his arm and serving in his country, and yet some of his, you know, relatives were put in camps. At the Smithsonian, we have a regent, Doris Matsui. We had a regent, Doris Matsui, congresswoman from California. I worked with her and knew her. She was born in one of those camps. And so when I look at this portrait and see that infant, I think of her. That was a very, very difficult chapter. And hopefully by displaying these objects, by talking about the objects, we also learn lessons from history. And I think that's what it's about. That, you know, look, Americans are, you know, divided on a lot of issues these days in our country, but it's an amazing country. It's a great country. It's achieved many things. And it's, you know, the American people need to know their history to move forward, I think. And this book is an attempt to do that.
Now, your book is about the history of America, but it's also about, you know, the importance of museums in another sense. Have you talked to people who have been through one of the museums and come away changed by something that they saw?
Oh, you know, look, it happens all the time, you know, particularly in Washington, where you get everybody from, you know, war veterans who come to we've had a whole slew of veterans from the Vietnam War come to Washington, and at the Smithsonian we have a display of a Huey helicopter. And you know, when veterans come and see that, they remember, you know, what that helicopter sounded like, even what it smelled like, because you know, those Hueys, well, they took they took soldiers into battle, but they also evacuated the wounded. Those were the helicopters that saved lives. And so, you know, it's sometimes very moving experience, and we'll have veterans who come, Vietnam veterans who come to American history, and they'll actually leave keepsakes and tokens at the exhibit. So it really, you know, it strikes that kind of chord. Similarly, you know, we've had I've taken foreign heads of state, you know, through the Smithsonian to our various museums, and they'll see certain things, and you know, they're kind of amazed at, you know, where America's come from and what we've overcome in some ways. In American history, we have right out there the Greensboro Counter, a section of the Greensboro Counter. This was a seminal artifact in the civil rights movement. This is where those four students from North Carolina A&T sat down on February 1st, 1960, and said they wanted to be served.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How did you get that?
Yeah, well, you know, we had talked to Woolworths for some time. It was a Woolworths. They'd been in business in Greensboro. We learned they were going out of business, and we asked them, and we said, you know, I know it's a lunch counter to you, but this is really an important artifact where people sat in to stand up for their rights, and we'd like to have a section of it. And Woolworth really complied. People in town helped us out. And talk about carpenters. Carpenters helped us take apart the counter because the counter seated about 60 people. We needed a section, you know, for about four. Yeah. We weren't going to take the whole thing. So they helped us out, and we trucked it up to the Smithsonian. And there it is. And, you know, I get people from other countries looking at that counter and understanding what the country overcame in order to, you know, spread rights among its various citizens.
I recently saw Lee Daniels' The Butler, and I have to say, having just seen that, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing a piece of that counter one day.
And yeah, well, and I knew Gene Allen was documented. The Butler movie is based on Gene Allen. And we did programs at the Smithsonian on workers at the White House, and we have a whole oral history, and we have Gene Allen telling all sorts of stories. So that part of the culture, it's not only the artifacts, but the documentation, the photographs and recordings that document history are also in the Smithsonian.
Fantastic. All right, let's take one more call. Joe with us in Madison. Hi, Joe.
Yeah. To sort of go along the same lines as you're talking about earlier with the difficult documenting difficult periods in our history, I think to include images from Abu Ghraib, the images of torture and the collateral murder video would be important to illustrate the change of consciousness our country has seen over the past few years.
All right. Well, thank you, Joe. And what do you think? Is that something the Smithsonian would be interested in?
Well, you know, we have to go with what we have in our collections, and we do not have that material in our collection. You know, but if we did, you know, and we did an exhibit, then those photographs would be on, you know, certainly on display.
All right, right now we're talking to Richard Curran. He's the Smithsonian Institution's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture, and he's the author of the book, The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects.
And you can join the conversation. Is there an iconic American object that you'd like to see in that list of 101, or you can add 102 and 103 to it as well? You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're picking up our conversation with Richard Curran. He's the Smithsonian Institution's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture. And we're talking about his new book. It's called The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects.
And you can join the fun at the Central Time Facebook page. What object would you like to see on that list? That's Central Time on WPR.
And let's go back to the phones. We have Joe waiting next from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I wonder, do you have any artifacts from Lewis and Clark? And I ask this because a number of years ago I toured Monticello, and as you stand in the foyer, there are artifacts from their expedition all around. And after we left, we went down across the lawn to his grave. And what struck me, I was standing there. I'd heard a good story about the whole thing as we head in history. But when I was standing there, this body is below me. And I think and it's really struck me as history is not a story, but it's reality. And these artifacts, I think, speak to that.
Oh, wonderful comment. Thanks, Joe. And what would you say? Do we have some Lewis and Clark in there?
We do, actually. One of the prized objects that's in the book, and of course in the Smithsonian, is the hand compass, the pocket compass that Lewis and Clark actually used to navigate their way across the continent. And so it still works. You know, when Thomas Jefferson asked, you know, Lewis and Clark to undertake the expedition, they had to be trained in the use of various materials, including, you know, compass and other, you know, sextant and so on, so they can make the maps, chart the way, and open up, you know, this land that the U.S. had acquired. So, you know, it's a marvelous object to look at that hand compass and realize that was in the hands of both Lewis and Clark.
Interesting. And they did pretty well for themselves with it, too.
Yep.
All right. Sure, let's move on to Samuel joining us from Ripon. Hi, Samuel.
Hi. How's it going?
Good.
I'm calling about how about a copy of the King James Bible? It's it was the influence on a lot of people and was the backing for a lot of big movements all through history in America. What about that?
Okay, the King James Bible. What about that one, Richard?
Well, we have, I mean, you know, there's a lot of versions of the King James Bible. One of the things I included in this book was the Bible that Thomas Jefferson had compiled, because Thomas Jefferson was looking at, you know, coming up with the, you know, what would be the right relationship with the country between religion and the state. And trying to assure freedom of religion. And so Thomas Jefferson, being who he was, ended up, he was fluent, he knew Greek, he knew Latin, he knew French, he knew English. So what we have in the Smithsonian is a one-of-a-kind Bible. It's the Bible that Thomas Jefferson did by compiling. What he did is he cut out the passages from French, Greek, Latin, and English versions, King James, and put them together in one volume. That's what we have at the Smithsonian.
Wow. Does that ever come out of retirement for anybody special, or is that just an artifact you have to look at?
No, you have to look at it. You know, it's not something we're going to pass around. Although, you know, back in the at the turn of the last century, Congress was so impressed with that that they ordered the Smithsonian. You know, the Smithsonian made copies of that, and it was distributed to all incoming members of Congress. And of course, you know, you can get it today. But it's you know, it's really an inspirational document because it shows how Jefferson was grappling with religion at the time.
Well, I wish we had more time, but it's been great to talk with you. It's such an amazing book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. And you could pass on the suggestions of your listeners, and we'll certainly take it into consideration for the next version.
All right, will do. Thank you. We've been talking to Richard Curran. He serves as the Smithsonian Institution's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture. He's the author of The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects.
Now we're going to check in on some news from our state capitol. There was a hearing on legislation today related to the proposed iron mine in northern Wisconsin and whether the public can access lands around the site. Gilman Halstead was there. Gilman, good to have you back.
Nice to be here, Rob.
So this has been one of these sub-controversies, I guess, related to this iron mine, whether access can be closed on these lands near the mine. What's the current state of affairs? You're telling me this legislation has passed the Senate.
Right. It's already passed the Senate, and it will very likely be on the Assembly floor next week. Today was a hearing. They're planning to exec it in the committee next Tuesday, I believe. And yeah, basically, the discussion at the hearing was about what the author of the bill calls eco-terrorism, and that it is designed to prevent protesters, people who oppose this mine, from interfering with the operations of the mining company. There was a big event back at June 11th of this year when some protesters accosted and actually assaulted, in some cases, some mining employees. And that's what prompted the bill. Senator Tom Tiffany, who sponsored it, said that that's the origin of the bill, and he thinks it's really necessary to protect those workers.
And how much land are we talking about here that would be off?
Now, that was part of the debate, actually. It's not exactly clear, although the Department of Natural Resources, which the bill would put as the authority for determining what land would be closed to public access and when, has estimated about 900 acres. In fact, they sent out a memo saying it was 897.64 acres. But it would be specifically 600-foot buffer zone around the areas where they're drilling for the samples for the iron mine, and around a 600-foot buffer around the roads that lead to those sites.
And the land in question is a bit funky. It's private land, but can you complete
that, but for me? It's under the managed forest land law, which basically gives the owners of the land a tax exemption if they allow it to be open to the public for recreation. And this bill would allow the company, well, through the DNR, to close that land to public access while this sampling is going on, but it also requires the mining company to pay a little bit extra, not quite the full tax, but a percentage of the tax that they would have to pay if they were closing the whole area. Now, I mean, this bill also, should note, is a compromise. Initially, Senator Tiffany wanted to close all 3,500 acres, and he agreed to a compromise that would draw these circles around the areas where the mining company was working.
Now, you mentioned the eco-terrorism argument being as one of the arguments in favor of this. What did we hear from people unhappy about this proposal?
Well, they're saying it's not really necessary, that it's unfair to people. It's going to be complicated to enforce. People won't know when land is open and exactly where it's open. And that since this one incident back in June 11th, there have been no significant threats, so they think it's unnecessary because of that as well, threats from protesters.
Today's hearing, was this just legislators, or were there members of the public, the company, that sort of thing?
Actually, the company was there. The DNR was there. All the testimony came from those three people, the authors of the bill, the mining company spokesperson talking about why it's needed, and the DNR about how they plan to enforce it. There were people who registered in favor, but there was no testimony from members of the public.
And then they're on the clock with this, right?
Right. They want to start doing this bulk sampling December 1st because they're leaving the land open even into the future, if this law stays in place, during the 9-day gun deer hunting season. And they're also leaving open trout fishing streams would be exempted from this, so that people who want to trout fish won't be prevented from doing that.
Looking ahead, is there any thought that this wouldn't pass in the time frame?
No. I don't think so. I mean, it passed the state Senate on a party line vote, and I think that it's the Republicans have a much bigger majority in the House, and there's strong support for it. So I think it likely will pass. I think this is one of many battles in this long war over the mine that will go on for possibly years once we get into the permitting process.
All right, Gilman, thanks as always for joining us. That was WPR reporter Gilman Halstead.
Coming up, we take a look at the smoke and mirrors of professional wrestling. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.